What I'm going to do is to open up, instead of like our chair introduced us as the panel which is going to stitch together things, but I think we are going to undo some of the stitches and probably put forth some thoughts which can lead to a conversation beyond this gathering. So having said that, then I will return to the central theme of this conference, which is the new histories of capitalism. It's a theme that has been present but overshadowed by questions of divergence, convergence. These are very important debates, yet they do not fully capture the form and nature of global capitalism. So, what if we begin by proposing that it is not just the divergence, convergence of the units of world economy that is at stake here, and that what is more critical is the modes of speculative capitalization, of commodification, that render these economic units into potential income-generating assets in the global economy. Let me ask you then to consider a different possibility, which goes beyond divergence-convergence paradigms, and one that is hidden in plain sight. That is the condition of emergence. By emergence, I first draw attention to the phenomena of emerging markets that has become a critical political economic force in the 21st century. Second, I refer to the speculative cycles of boom and bust that create economic miracles every now and then around the world. To emerge is to become visible in the eyes of investors, policymakers, and even the own citizens of that economic unit as investment-worthy and market-ready destinations for global capital. What I'm referring to is the phenomena of attractive investment destinations that have appeared especially in the global south. From BRICS to Next 11, from India, China, Brazil, Russia, South Africa to Rwanda, Sri Lanka, Angola, Myanmar, as the tagline goes, they are open to business, and in doing so, have emerged as new frontiers of global capitalism. The untapped territories that are about or promise to realize their economic potential. These are the capitalist growth stories that are unfolding around the world, all subject to the cycles of boom and bust, of emergence, and also the risk of falling off the radar of global investors. So the questions which have been at the core of my long-term research are that when and how did the third world transform into emerging market in the global economy, and what kind of new modes of imagination and knowledge might be at heart of this historical shift? So I address some of these questions in my forthcoming book, Brand New Nation. But just to say, this is not an actual cover. There is no cover. We are negotiating the cover. But this is just to say that some of the questions are addressed in my forthcoming book, but it is also something which I pursue in my ongoing work. So I think I'll begin by taking you to the main street of Davos during the World Economic Forum annual meeting in 2012, where you would see colorful billboards, many of the buildings display. India, land of limitless opportunity, make in India, Malaysia doing business, building friendships, Brazil, a country of opportunity, innovation, sustainability, Mexico seize the day, Egypt, invest in future, proudly South Africa, imagine new ways. Or you would hear people talking about cool Japan, creative Korea, amazing Thailand, wonderful Indonesia, Russia, the whole world within, Azerbaijan, land of magical colors. I mean, actually the list is so long that I will not be reading it out. It is endless and it is still growing, because to be a proper nation today means that you must have a brand identity. So to an outsider, the nature of exchange performed in this global marketplace will not be readily apparent. After all, the pavilions, which I'm referring to over here, do not exhibit any specific objects, either manufactured or designed in or extracted from these national enclaves. Most of the pavilions, in fact, are sparsely furnished, dressed in the global aesthetics of comfortable functional offices or even luxury airport lounges frequented by busy travelers. The visible clues, if any, lie in the publicity script itself, where the nations are re-inscribed in the effective language of promise and potentiality. So what is on display here is a yet unfolding process of commodification of the nation form, or what Jean and John Comaroff have been calling nationality incorporated, or the transformation of the nation into a business enterprise. The nations, mostly from the global south, make their appearance in a new role as branded commodities or lucrative emerging markets in policy parlance. Here comes the public policy part. The thing offered for exchange, then, is the nation in its commodity form, pitched as an attractive investment destination, the yet untapped surplus that the global elite are invited to explore. This phenomena is what I call the emergence of the brand new nation, recrafted and repackaged as a branded enclosure for capital in the 21st century, which has emerged from within the structures of unbridled free markets, centralized state governance, and spectacular imagination of utopian dream worlds in capitalist designs. This form emerged from an ongoing historical shift, the capitalist transformation of the nation state, wherein the logic of capital is the glue holding the nation and state together. The nation in this scheme is imagined as a vast enclosure of production, its territory a reserve of untapped natural resources, its population as potential producer-consumer of goods and services, its cultural essence, its unique nation brand that distinguishes it from all other investment destinations. All of this can be capitalized and turned into income-generating assets. The state is the authority that manages the income-generating capacity of the national enclosure and holds the power to visualize, brand, legislate, and spatially rearrange the national enclosure as a market-ready investment destination. This process of capitalization is what binds the nation to the state, a process that unfolds along a visual re-territorialization of the national enclosure as a distinct economic zone and a unified cultural political identity. So in my work, I examine how this brand new nation came to be. I particularly address the entanglements between exploration and investment, underpinning the making of the nation form into commodity form. To be sure, these entanglements are not new. The world history is replete with accounts of adventurous explorers who traveled far and wide in search of new opportunities. Yet the 21st century moment is different. It enframes the world as commodity, a world that can be measured, monitored, and ranked upon seemingly objective indicators of economic growth. So the world as exhibition once conjured a world of representation of commodities and merchandise extracted in the colonies and advertised and desired in the metropoles. In contrast, the world as commodity, I argue, captures and encloses entire territory to be transformed into a site of unlimited commodification and exchange, and actualize the capitalist dream of unending growth. So the world as commodity comes into being through a new body of useful knowledge, modes of knowing, and making oneself known. Just to be sure, this is not a one-way street. This is happening both ways. Crucial to the formation of new imaginaries. So a world grasped and imagined as a commodity form is what eventually can be put at the disposal of investors. If the early modern era came to be known as the age of discovery, when distant world territories were encountered and mapped in search of valuable commodities, the ongoing explorations, particularly in the global south, represent the moment of rediscovery of that already familiar world. So I argue further that what is unknown in this project of rediscovery of the world is not its physical shape and features of the world, which are both visible and legible in minute details. You can just Google even your street. But what is to be rediscovered or what is unknown is the potentiality and availability of territories that can generate commercial value in the global economy. This speculative index of the yet untapped territories of rapidly opening up across continents is what underpins the taxonomy of emerging markets that has come to define the contemporary world. Moreover, the rediscovery constitutes a dramatic transformation of the sign itself as the mid-20th century third world is reclassified and renamed as emerging market in the 21st century. If the third world, once known as the developing, underdeveloped, periphery, aid recipient, poor South, signaled despair and pessimism of territories forever lagging behind the developed North, its rediscovery as emerging market, in contrast, conveys hope, optimism, and a world full of possibilities. The key enabling this shift is its visible market potential, deemed untapped and accessible that investors and policymakers are drawn to. So I will quickly move on to that. How did this change come about? And this is actually quite an interesting story. The history of the emerging markets is often linked to the idea of BRICS that gained popular currency more than a decade ago. Proposed by a Goldman Sachs banker as the growth map of the future in 2001, the catchy acronym comprising four of the world's most populous and resource-rich nations, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, came to dominate the global language of investment and policymaking. Yet the idea of emerging markets precedes BRICS by more than two decades. In fact, as early as 1950s, the idea of foreign investment as a development strategy had already begun taking roots. In 1956, the International Finance Corporation, a World Bank subsidiary, was formed to, I quote, to stimulate private investment as a means of ending extreme poverty and boosting shared prosperity with a starting capital of US $100 million. The belief, I quote, that private sector is essential to development, unquote, underpinned the IFC activities in the Third World, where it offered loans or invested directly in Asian, African, and Latin American corporations. So in 1981, the role of private capital in Third World economies was further consolidated in a new IFC initiative named as the Third World Equity Fund. It invited investors to take a look at the developing countries, giving the possibility, I quote, possibility of making real money, unquote, in these territories. This moment is remembered as a key shift that unfolded in a dramatic manner. Antoine van Achtmel, the investment banker credited with initiating this project, recalls that the initial lack of enthusiasm among the investors who had assembled at the headquarters of Salomon Brothers in New York City, he was entrusted with the task of making a pitch to potential investors by convincing them with data that showed developing nations enjoyed higher economic growth rates and promising companies that have been ignored thus far. So the assembly included 30 bankers from major investment institutions such as JP Morgan, TIA, ACRIF, and Salomon Brothers. While they found the idea interesting, the name Third World Equity Fund was the turnoff as his pitch failed to have the desired impact. So Achtmel notes, I quote, we had the goods, we had the data, we had the countries, we had the companies. What we did not have, however, was an elevator pitch that liberated these developing economies from the stigma of being labeled as third world basket cases. An image rife with negative associations of flimsy polyester, cheap toys, rampant corruption, Soviet-style tractors, and flooded rice paddies, unquote. So the name Third World came with a heavy baggage that could not be offloaded easily. If it invoked the moment of decolonization in several nations across Asia, Africa, and Latin America, it was also a reminder of the global development aid regime of the newly independent, albeit deemed underdeveloped nations, forever lagging behind than their northern counterparts. And if the Non-Aligned Movement and Bandung Conference celebrated Third World solidarity in their newfound freedom, the discourse of corruption and immature democracies hinted at the unpreparedness of these nations for full autonomy. So it is against these considerations that Achtmel found, I quote, a term that sounded more positive and invigorating, emerging markets. Third World suggested stagnation, emerging markets suggested progress, uplift, and dynamism. The name was designed, as he later recalled, I quote, to give it a more uplifting feeling to what one had originally called the Third World Fund, unquote. So what we witness in this name change act is a desire to make a clean break in history intended to keep the Third World and emerging markets in separate enclosures. The name is deployed, and actually I think it's very important to think in terms of convergent divergence because it's not a straightforward case over here. It's the same territory we are speaking about, and it converges and divergences can be there within those territories. So the new name deployed as an instant mood booster that can potentially uplift a part of the world that had long been imagined as sliding down on the political economic ladder. So the prefix emerging works to brighten up, to enhance the positive outlook while creating a clear distance from all the negatives attached to the idea of Third World. This transition from the third world to emerging market received another breakthrough when the Cold War ended and the free markets became a firm foreign policy agenda pursued aggressively in the 1990s by the Clinton administration. A documentary film called The Commanding Heights shows how the new agenda was termed as triumph of, I quote, more countries than ever have adopted market economies, unquote. The then Prime Minister of Malaysia, Mahathir bin Mohamad, wearily described the moment as follows, I quote, once communism was defeated, then capitalism could expand and show its true self. There is nothing to restrain capital, and capital is demanding that it should be able to go anywhere and do whatever it likes, unquote. Interestingly, this section of the film is entitled Emerging Market Hunters, that emphasized not only the elements of rediscovery of the already familiar world, it also suggested the thrill of chase and capture of new nation-turns markets. And indeed, the goal of, I quote, capturing that growth and of course making money for investors, unquote, was what drove investment fund managers to the third world. So finally, I will speak about what is it that makes a nation-turned market attractive in the eyes of investors, and how do investors explore and imagine this commodified world in the 21st century? If spectacular expeditions undertaken by adventurous explorers were the hallmark of an earlier era, the contemporary exploration is a routine practice facilitated by financial experts and a fast-growing body of popular and specialist literature on market and investments. So the 21st century investor explorer, we are told, doesn't, I quote, doesn't need a passport, only a desire to discover more about the economic opportunities in the world today, unquote. This mode of rediscovery entails taking, I quote, a long, hard look at the world. You may not have done this at any great length since the sixth grade, but time spent studying a world map can never be wasted and can be critical to your success as a global investor, unquote. This advice to rediscover the world, whose physical contours ought to be familiar even to a sixth grade student, is offered by Mark Mobius, who's a financial star expert. The executive director, one of the early movers in the 1980s to invest in the emerging markets. The long, hard look he prescribes is an invitation to see what for long might have been overlooked, namely the full economic potential of the third world. So, I mean, I have a lot to say about this, and if it is only because I can entertain you about financial experts and the way they write about the world, which is no longer this despairing thought, but now it is not only able to look after itself, but it is also seen as hope for global capitalism as such. So just to say a little bit about the sexual connotation, which is that this is the growth map. This is Economist. I'm writing an entire paper on the Economist and the kind of art they produced, because economy is nothing which can be boiled down to measurable numbers. It is actually in this beautiful imagery that I tried to think that what if it wasn't economists but artists who were imagining this financial world. So it's much fun. So please look at this map. This map comes from Morgan Stanley Bank, and this is called the heat map. And actually, it's an interactive tool. You can go on the internet, you can just go to their site and figure out which market is in heat. And I do not need to dwell upon the kind of, the fact that you think about, investors as market hunters, territories as virgin. And they are mostly depicted as women or as wildlife animals, as I have showed you. And these are actually the old colonial imagery which has been re-inscribed into the financial world. But the connotation of capturing, hunting, still remains the same. And the fact that it is sexually loaded. Are you in heat? Is Brazil in heat today, or is it India? Right? So I think I will conclude about the new economic frontiers which are opening up for us, which is that the world as commodity, I conclude, is in constant flux. The old settled associations of North rich developed and South poor developing increasingly appear to be unstable. the ability of capital, forever in search of cheap labor and resources, to overcome national boundaries means an unending cycle of extraction, enrichment, and eventually abandonment. And this is where I think the divergence, convergence is something in constant speculative flux. Without a shade of irony, then, we hear about the third worldization of the first world, or the South in the North, to describe zones of deprivation created after the partial loss of manufacturing operations in Euro-America. The idea of third world has not expired, I suggest. It has simply expanded into new locations. At the same time, the logic of market competition between locations, North and South, is what becomes more apparent. The post-colony turned emerging market frontier is neither lagging behind nor playing catch-up. It forever foreshadows the way in which global political economy is being reshaped. I'll end by saying that as we think about convergence and divergence, we ought to think about the whole political economy of emergence, which binds the North and the South in ways which we had not anticipated thus far. Thank you.